Good morning. Welcome to a panel discussion on Christianity and popular culture. We're going to talk about Eden, Avatar, and the Kingdom of Christ. What in the world are we supposed to do with popular culture? In the past few weeks, the James Cameron movie, Avatar, has passed the $1.8 billion mark in terms of box office sales, eclipsing his earlier blockbuster, Titanic. And it occasions an opportunity for our conversation about popular culture because in this one movie, we have not only a box office sensation and blockbuster movie, we have a real challenge to considering how Christians should consider popular culture and engage with the conversation that is prompted by Hollywood and the rest of what amounts to an entire universe of popular culture in which most of us and virtually everyone we will speak to is immersed. In his book, The Great Movies, Roger Ebert said, "We live in a box of space and time. Movies are windows in its walls. They allow us to enter other minds, not simply in the sense of identifying with the characters, although that is an important part of it, but by seeing the world through another person's eyes as another person sees it." The Apostle Paul wrote, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Evangelical Christians in particular have not known exactly what to do with Hollywood from the very beginning. And that has been true, at least in some sense, for the Christian church and popular culture, going all the way back to the early Christians and the Roman entertainments, including the gladiatorial games. The Banner, which is an old Reformed publication from the Christian Reformed Church, described what comes out of Hollywood as a moral bubonic plague. Charles Finney said, "No saved person should ever read a novel." We're going to have an interesting conversation today based upon how many Christians think about these things and concern for the fact that many Christians don't think about these things as they should. The panel is ready to talk about this. The far extreme here on the panel, in more ways perhaps than one, Dr. Mark Coppinger, professor of Christian apologetics, Jim Parker, who is professor and associate dean of worldview and culture for the School of Theology, Russell Moore, professor of theology and ethics, and executive vice president, senior vice president for academic administration, and Ted Cable, who is also professor of apologetics and worldview. Gentlemen, this is a conversation we need to have. The question is, where in the world do we begin? The title of this panel, Eden, Avatar, and the Kingdom of Christ, is not accidental. What we have in Avatar is a new secular Eden, or at least an Eden very different than the Eden we find in the book of Genesis. What do we make of this?
I will say this: there is a hunger for Eden and something paradise-like. I was looking at the Chicago train system last night at the Metro system and the CTA. 60 stations have a sort of paradise Eden name. There are over 20 parks: Melrose Park, Oak Park, Highland Park, Lake Forest, Buffalo Grove, Willow Springs. There's never a stop that says called like Asphalt Expanse or, you know, concertina wire with flapping plastic grocery bag. We have that hunger, and so we fashion a variety of movies. I mean, from Dances with Wolves to we've talked about Cocoon this morning. That there is this hunger, but the world supplies it in very ideological, ungodly ways, I'll have to say. I won't rattle on, but a lot of these other guys pitch in.
In highly technological, three-dimensional ways.
Right. Let me say one quick thing. It struck me this morning that, you know, the sky guys who come in, the dangerous guys with the high technology, the dangerous fellows who are attacking the primitive people, I kind of thought of this movie as one of those, that you have the simple people making facing the giants and fireproof down there with the little inexpensive stuff. We're trying to do our little less than high production value Christian films. And then comes in the Sky Warriors with their massive budgets, and they're blowing up Christian values and teaching animism. So I think that movie was that big mothership coming in with the helicopters around it. I can expand on that, but it's those are the rich guys. I mean, fools with a lot of money.
I now believe you've seen it.
I saw it.
All right.
Took my little notes here.
Yeah. Dr. Parker?
Well, as far as Eden goes, I think there is this longing for Eden. Of course, C.S. Lewis, that's one way he ultimately became a Christian. There was this longing, this unfulfilled, well, something that could not be fulfilled in this life. And when you read some of the articles about people who've come out of the movie, who are in deep depression and suicidal because they can't, you know, this Eden isn't real. It doesn't exist. And it does exist, but it doesn't exist through pantheism or animism. And the great and glorious news of the gospel is there shall be new heavens and new earth. There shall, this Eden shall be restored, and it shall actually be available to human beings.
A study indicated that a significant number of persons, frankly a frightening percentage of persons, said that they would rather live in Pandora or on Pandora than here on Earth. And they interviewed some young people in this article that said that that they would be willing to start life all over again if they could wake up and be on Pandora rather than here on Earth. I have to say, I appreciate what a local radio personality, Terry Miner, said. He said it would be his luck to wake up and find himself in Alvin and the Chipmunks. And so the idea that somehow the movie is presenting a superior creation to the one we know is frankly a challenge, isn't it, Dr. Moore?
Yes, and there's always going to be that kind of person who wants to escape from life. I mean, we all know the Star Trek convention guy. And we all knew that guy in high school who's just obsessed with whatever the particular movie or television series or film is as a way of escape. It seems like when you look at these things, they kind of bounce back and forth between utopia, between this vision of Eden, and then dystopia, between some sense of the apocalypse. So that you've got Avatar, but you also have The Road, which has all of humanity essentially being destroyed except for a remnant. You have Planet of the Apes. You have all of these pictures of the universe as we know it being day after tomorrow. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So it seems to me that in popular culture, you have people's longings, and then you also have that fear of death and that fear of judgment, and they're being expressed the best way that they know how. And then you have people who are kind of looking at those things, and it resonates, sometimes deeper than they understand why it resonates. There's a sense of, yeah, I'm scared of that, and yeah, I'm really longing for that. And then, especially when you look at Avatar, when you have people who are spending so much of their lives in front of screens, some of the things that are the most remarkable in Avatar are simply being outside in nature. It's 3D, but nature is 3D. And you have people who are in awe about these pictures of mountains that are floating, but it's because they've never been around mountains that are not floating, but that are real. They just don't experience it, and it awakens something within them, I think.
It's interesting that you mentioned in juxtaposition Avatar and The Road, because both are now a focus of a lot of attention in the movie world with cinematography, because they spent vast amounts of money, in the case of Avatar, to create this Edenic kind of world far from Earth, the whole point being that it's not Earth and is morally superior to Earth. And for The Road, they had to come up with ways to basically destroy the Earth. And, you know, there are interesting articles out there showing how they had to use vast amounts of money to create these realistic sets about a dystopia rather than a utopia. And the interesting thing is that people want to go to both of these movies. Both of them are Hollywood successes, although Avatar far superior in terms of the box office return. But when you start looking at why we're drawn to those things, I think it's because we're drawn to a knowledge of sin and its effects, as in The Road. But we're also drawn to a hope for something better. It's just rather superficial to see how Hollywood spends all this money spending imagination to try to get at where the Christian gospel has been all along. Dr. Cable?
Worldviews always contain an Eden and an eschaton and a problem in between that must be solved. And so it's a little surprise that a movie like Cameron's are going to present that, and you have people who are longing for it and will, in one case, commit suicide because they can't ever get to this Eden. The problem isn't that there's a longing for Eden or a longing for something that's beautiful and good. The problem is the answer that the movie presents, of course. And it reminds me a bit of, say, Rousseau's State of Nature, if you can just get people out of civilization, or Thoreau, you know, if you can get back to a pond, it'll all be okay. Or it actually reminds me of my childhood. One of my favorite movies as a child was Tarzan, the old 30s Johnny Weissmuller, where, you know, Jane comes from the outside and, you know, primitive is better. You know, you almost get eaten by crocs on your morning swim, but Tarzan's there to protect you. The animals are all there to help and to cheer. And if the bad guys from the outside world come in, you just make a, you know, an ape call, and here comes the elephant. Sort of the example you see in this movie of the weird dinosaurs come to the aid of the people. So it reminded me a lot of that. The problem with the movie is, of course, that primitive cultures are not like what we see in the movie. They're called primitive traditionally for a reason, not just because they don't have technology. Just as we see the Na'vi people wear war paint, they learned it somewhere. They cry when they kill an animal. They don't seem to cry when they kill, you know, the bad guys. They, you know, in real life, primitive people can be pretty ugly. And so a return to nature may be a nice longing, but it can also end up with sort of a Unabomber mentality. He wanted to do the same thing.
You know, let's think about this for a minute. What about humanity in this film, in particular the human characters, not the Na'vi, but the human characters? This is sort of like a massive three-dimensional telling of what we hear in Bambi, a movie that both thrilled and traumatized generations of children. Man has entered the forest. Where all, you know, those chilling words, you know, that humanity is now a blight upon the earth.
Right.
It's fascinating that this film is so undisguised, so un-nuanced in terms of its antipathy towards human beings. What do we make of that, Mark?
Let me say, I think I wrote this once, that some of the best movies are invisible movies, that you that you're not really aware you're in a movie, and it blows it if you're in a Western and then you see a contrail from a jet going across the sky and it just screams artifice. And this thing screamed at every point, saying, you know, I'm doing a hack job here, I've overlooked that, and so forth. And one of the big things it screams is just, as you say, hatred of humanity. This it's a romanticism, it's an adoration of as he says, the primitive. And if you want to see the primitive, just go to Pine Ridge or something like that and see shacks with visqueen flapping in the wind, with alcoholic people lying on the ground. They worship the sun, the trees, and so forth. It's a terrible, terrible lie about humanity. It hates man, and he hates capitalism. He hates man. He hates the army. He hates, I think he hates, like, sexual and purity. I mean, it's just his whole package of things is so anti-Christian and sub-Christian, but he's got the money to defame it all, and it's shocking to me. And in our town, there was this great applause at the end, and perhaps it was a standing ovation. Evanston is like the People's Republic of Evanston, and it was really sort of like a Harlequin romance for liberals or something like that. They, you know, kind of a liberal porn or a bodice ripper or something like that.
Let me remind you that this is going to be broadcast and you have to go home.
That's right. I'm just saying it was just like catnip to the people in the congregation. Yes, we hate capital. We hate the military. We hate this, this, and this. And by the way, we love animals. And you're right. You kill the animal with great reverence. And I'm sure the animal was impressed. You know, they had a bonding there when he's being killed. But, yeah, slaughter these people left and right. It's the strangest thing.
Well, we can track this a bit later, but the capitalism angle is fascinating because, of course, all this technology, which Cameron has pioneered, he did it first for the Titanic, has been known for it in his other films, but massive multi-millions of dollars of new technology to create this 3D animation, and Hollywood is celebrating the fact that he is this engineer and artist of such tremendous technological ability. That is an artifact of capitalism.
It is.
And by the way, he's charging for people to see that movie. He is a capitalist.
Yeah, I mean, 20th Century Fox is distributing it, and he's using materials from all over the place. I mean, self-referentially, it's really inconsistent. By the way, I did want to think one thing about this element, unobtainium. Was that what it was called?
Yeah, it's very clever. None of us got it.
Yeah, I mean, I was right. Boy. Subtlety, but I was thinking, like, what if this was? I was reading today about a medicine called ruthenium. It was a rare metal, and it's taken from platinum, and it treats colon cancer, and you have to refine it to the far ends of the earth. What if unobtainium was some sort of medicine that would cure colon cancer? I mean, they just act as though industry and mining and so forth is all evil, and so.
I want to point out something, though. Unobtainium is a standard sci-fi word. If you go back and look in the history of sci-fi, this movie, and Cameron's always loved sci-fi.
You are a Trekkie, then.
No, I'm not.
Sorry, Ted.
My version of Leonard Nimoy is back to Mission Impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
That dates me. But there's a lot of standard sci-fi in this movie. I mean, it acts like it's making a pitch for spiritualism of some sort. In fact, it holds out to a kind of physicalist, that is, materialist understanding of even the religion there. You remember when Grace Sigourney Weaver, she kind of sees it after a while. And so, but what is it? It's a neural network of everything connecting. That's what's really valuable there, not the unobtainium. And so, as you're pointing out, the way you get to explore all this on the part of Jake is through technology. You got to be uploaded and downloaded. That's all technology. That's all standard sci-fi. So the interesting thing is, as you're pointing out, research and development and capitalism is what has always pushed along the edges of technology, and Cameron's using this. He had to wait to make the movie. And now he's making lots of money, I felt, from my pocket when I went in there to see it. 3D costs a whole hop more to go see. You make more money on it. Number two, there are books coming out, field guides on Avatar. There's the James Cameron game Avatar now coming out that you can see where he's pitching it. And finally, Mattel action figures. So there's a lot of money to be made.
Figures. What's that? Keep in mind, Happy Meals that have the products you sell along with it as tied.
It's very capitalist, isn't it? Yeah.
Russ, you described the movie as Rambo in reverse.
Yeah, you have what you have is really a turning against the military. And what worried me about the movie is it wasn't so much that it was anti-military, it was anti-authority. And there was a celebration of a revolt against authority and against kind of a nihilism that's there, that's in the freedom of the people uniting against it. And the thing that was interesting to me is I was watching it not in the People's Republic of Evanston, but in a blue-collar neighborhood in Louisville, Kentucky, where you have a bunch of people who are voting for John McCain and listening to Merle Haggard and have the little "I support our troops" bumper stickers. And at the end of the movie, they're standing up and applauding too. And what concerns me is not so much the message, but the fact that most people aren't really getting or seeing the message. And you keep in mind, this is the same guy who had evangelical Christians standing up and applauding to scenes of fornication in Titanic. It's so subtle the way that it works through that you become emotionally connected before you really realize what's going on. And that's what worries me, is not so much the kinds of propaganda that come through that are so obvious, but the kinds of propaganda that come in that shape us and change us in ways we don't even recognize, we don't even see. And so if you're able to get that guy to make the disconnect between what he is saying and thinking the rest of the week and between what he's feeling right then, well, you can do that with almost anything.
Francis Schaeffer points out just the point you're making. That is the power of film.
Yeah.
And that's the power of the emotional manipulative power of film. And so you can enjoy a film on a certain level, maybe the cinematography or maybe something else. But when you find yourself rooting for what you know to be wrong rationally, it shows the incredible power that it has over people. And that's why it is such an incredibly powerful medium.
We're going to come back to that. But just looking at the storyline of Avatar, it's got its own evangelistic message. It's got its own meta-narrative, you know, the Christian meta-narrative of creation, fall, redemption, consummation. It's all there. It's got its own apocalypse, and it's got its own religion. And interestingly, when you look at the screenplay, it's very clear that the religious message is pointed in a way that you might not catch watching it. There's an insistence that this is not some kind of superficial religion. There's the insistence this is real religion. This pantheism with the tree and its interconnected roots and all the rest. By the way, we did catch that Sigourney Weaver's character is named Dr. Grace Augustine. James Cameron knows what he's doing here. There are hints of reference points to the Christian gospel in this recasting of a completely different gospel.
You know, in teaching environmental ethics a couple years ago at Elmhurst College, I took the standard text they were using. It was by McGraw-Hill, a textbook publisher. I think they had 84 readings, and of the 84, three were Christian. I mean, there were St. Francis and Annie Dillard and I think Wendell Berry. And the rest were all over the place, but Gaia, you know, the sort of Earth Mother pantheism thing, was everywhere, and it's so strong that people are actually appreciating Spinoza now. I mean, he's one of the most unreadable philosophers. I mean, it's just wacky what he's written, and it's obscure. But they love the way he says that there's one substance, and that substance is God, and everything is God, and so forth. So they're even driven so much by this pantheism and panentheism to read obscure philosophers. It's a huge, huge movement, but it's the religion of the environmental movement, I have to say. Now, I mean, you have the Cornwall Alliance, and there's some people who believe in the environment who, you know, care for it in Christian circles, but it's a massive religion now.
Russ Duthat, writing the New York Times, said that it shows that Americans are kind of natively pantheistic or panentheistic. Right. And I think there's a good element to that. You know, there have been some recent surveys showing that a large number of persons who identify even as Christians say that they believe that there is a cosmic energy that is found in trees and rocks and other material objects. So this movie's tapping into something that's more than a market. It's tapping into some kind of religious longing on the parts of the people who watch the movie.
I was picking up on one thing Dr. Moore said. It's so odd that you have to create this sort of black light shop paradise when the world we're in is the most beautiful thing on earth. I mean, whether you're from the Rockies or the Great Plains or the, you know, the Southern Pine Forest, there's nothing to beat that. But he takes us into this black light poster shop from the 60s, and we put on the little glasses like we did in the 50s. You know, it's so retro, but God's creation is extraordinarily splendid as it is.
I would have to say that the 3D in Avatar is a whole lot better than the 3D I saw as a kid in the.
We have quantum leap in technology. Yeah,
you're just getting too old to remember how bad those were. But I mean, when the guy throws a spear at you and you put your glasses on it. But anyhow, to me the thing that leapt out was in fact this over-religious message. I mean, it's the name of the movie is sort of, for a Christian, a little bit of a concern immediately, which Cameron knows what he's doing. It is a glorification of pantheism all the way. And as you point out, Cameron knows exactly what he's doing in the whole gospel thing, because let's remember, just a couple of years ago, he's the one that was the executive producer for The Lost Tomb of Jesus.
Absolutely.
On the Discovery Channel, trying to say we found, you know, this bogus nonsense, we found the original tomb of Jesus and his family. So, you know, Cameron's in your face, even though it's got a mixture of sci-fi where the religion can be explained in naturalistic terms, it's still very much appealing to the average, what I like to call postmodern religionist, who's, you know, he's not real clear as to what he's after. It doesn't matter if it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, everything is God impersonally, but you can also pray to this God. And so at the end, AY answers the prayer, you know. And so you're like, okay, mix a little personal God in there for those Americans that like prayer, you know.
Russ Duthat did refer to the movie as a long apologia for pantheism. Jeffrey Wells said, it is the most flamboyant, costliest, grandest, left-liberal super movie anyone's ever seen. That's packing a whole lot into it. But it is a super movie. So let's talk about it for a moment. It is nonetheless fun to watch. That's the thing. It has a story, and it comes with all this technology. And so we've seen a progression of technology from just in the last generation or so, from the kind of cardboard cutout figures that looked and spoke like that in science fiction to now what appears, as one reviewer said, more real than reality. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with that? Mm-hmm. Russ, what do we do with more real than reality?
Well, I think it's what Mark was mentioning a few minutes ago about the paradise we're living in. You think about the way people will even talk about beautiful things in nature that they see. It's like a movie.
Yeah.
Or it's like a film.
That's right.
That's right. What they're saying is this can't be real because it's so good.
Yeah.
Because they're so accustomed to seeing everything through that grid. And, I think the interesting thing about what Ross Douthat said in the New York Times piece is James Cameron is a capitalist. He's trying to make money. He's not doing a religious message that people don't want to hear. Otherwise, he wouldn't be making the money. So there's a market out there. And I think there's a dark side to it that we've mentioned, but there's also a great reason for hope. I mean, we really are not moving into the kind of world that Star Trek envisioned, in which people aren't concerned about spiritual matters or ultimate matters or eschatology. We really are moving into a world in which people are paganizing, but they're paganizing in a way that even the paganism has to have a counterfeit kind of Christianity in order to address their longings. And that's not just in Avatar. You think of the movie I Am Legend, which is a dystopia, and you've got the entire world falling apart. How do you save the world? It's through blood. You have to find pure blood that gives a transfusion. Well, they're just sapping old stories that are true in order to market them to people who are longing for them in the first place.
You know, one of the alien creatures, one of the Na'vi in Avatar says every person is born twice.
Yeah.
The second time is when you are a part of your people forever.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there's even a born-again element to this.
Exactly.
I want to test a theory with the panel here. It seems to me that Hollywood, oddly enough, in spite of whatever it may hold as its own secular pretensions, can't be as secular as it wants to be.
Right.
And it seems to me that as it presents its own mythos, its own story, it's really, really good in many ways at showing human sinfulness and human depravity. It just doesn't know what in the world to do with the other necessary part of the story, which is redemption.
I used to get more upset about that they just could not sort it all out. And then it occurred to me that they really don't have a clue. I mean, it's sort of like a cat trying to do algebra. They just don't understand it, and so they give it their best shot in some cases. But it is a heartache. I tell you, I mean, we have ourselves to blame in a large respect. When I went to Wheaton back in the 70s, 10 years before I showed up, you couldn't go to a movie if you went to Wheaton. And I noticed about that time there was a magazine called Eternity, which actually folded, which is kind of odd. But at any rate, there was a film critic named Harvey Kahn, and he wrote once about his film reviews, and he says, you know, we get so much flack here reviewing films, and he says, it's not the content of the review, it's the fact of the review.
Right.
The Christians say, why would you dignify any discussion with pay, and I got pretty much the same thing from Marvin Alasky with World Magazine, that, and so we have turned Hollywood over to the non-evangelicals, and we've come to the place, you know, we're sort of like Muslims who can blow up cars but they just can't build them. We are guys who can blow up movies, as we are in a sense today, but we can't build a movie like that because we have not devoted so much to the screen, to the power of it, to the production values. And so we sort of look out there and say, wow, they really do good work here. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, well, I'm going to respond to that by saying we can't do that. It's just like the great and rather futile great evangelical hope in the mid-1950s for a great evangelical university. You can't meet the medium on its own terms. And that's the problem. And I'm not saying Christians should not be involved in the film industry, and thankfully there are many Christians who are involved in different elements of the movie industry, and there are movies, oddly enough, that have told the story well, or at least have told the story in a way that is conducive to and not in conflict with the Christian meta-narrative and the gospel. But as much as we are called to be transformational in every element of life, and it's still true that in order to make it in Hollywood, you've got to have the backing of people financially who have a very different goal. And at the bottom line, as Michael Medved said, you know, Hollywood has a great suicide wish. Yeah. You know, it continues to make these blockbuster movies that no one watches with you know, these storylines that are directly and antipathetic.
Yeah.
And opposed to the Christian truth. And so many of those just crash and burn, you know, the great movies that that verge on pornography and all the rest. That
Last Temptation of Christ.
Exactly, yeah, that are supposed classic. To be blockbusters and yeah. don't end up being blockbusters. Yeah, right. So what happens is they come in with an angle, which is kind of like the almost pseudo-story. And that sells. It obviously does sell.
Yeah.
Romance sells, Titanic. The Gaia hypothesis sells. She is real, insists one of the Na'vi about
right.
Pandora.
Yeah, I think that one reason the movie is so appealing, you ask why does it appeal so much, is not just because it touches the deep longings that we have, but it also is so powerful precisely because of the technology that mirrors the real world. I mean, they actually spent money to send the cast over to Hawaii to walk in a rainforest to feel like that experience when they're acting. What I didn't understand till I looked behind the scenes at what's going on, the actors, for instance, Neytiri, you never see the real person, had to study it for months, practice to make all those athletic moves, and she's in a bodysuit where Cameron has this remarkable groundbreaking technology filming these sensors on her body so that that can immediately be translated via these remarkable cameras into CGI. They have a little boom wide-angle lens on her face at the whole time they're making this so that they can capture facial expressions. The graphic artists that work on it copied undersea oceanic creatures. They copy the flora and fauna of the real world. In other words, the movie's so powerful precisely because it is this world, and as Dr. Moore says, it's, you know, people that are not very in tune with the real world anymore are pretty amazed by it. So I think a Christian can applaud a very powerful, wonderful experience. And like one Christian said to me, if you can either kind of decide you're going to ignore the giant tree God for a while, you can really root for the good guys against the bad guys and have a wonderful experience.
Well, and you also have, I mean, you have Romans 2 there. There is sin here, and there's judgment, and there's a very clear delineation between what that is. That's exactly what Paul's talking about the conscience. It's redirected, it's misdirected, it's perverted, but it is there. And that's something that's very common in these films, is the idea of apocalypse, the idea of judgment, and then restoration after that. Now, I read an anthropologist, sociologist, who said one of the reasons why September 11th, 2001, people kept referring to the experience as surreal is because they have seen New York City destroyed so many times in films. It was almost as though they're watching something they had seen over and over again, because that idea of judgment. That happens there at the end of Avatar. There's a judgment against the evildoers. Well, where does that even come from? That's not Hindu. That's rooted in humanity,
that's right.
For a reason.
There is so much to talk about here. Just given Avatar the movie, we could spend hours dissecting it and talking about it, and I think profitably so, because it has such an impact, at least temporarily, in popular culture. It has crystallized a moment, and obviously it has captured an attention on the part of the American public that is fascinating. Mark, you mentioned that when you went to Wheaton back in the 1970s, either you could not then go to the movies,
it was,
or
10 years after the Prohibition.
There you go. All you have to do is look at the history of how Christians have responded to popular culture, and you realize it's always been awkward. This isn't new. You can look at the Patristic Fathers, and there is great revulsion.
Tertullian.
Exactly, toward the popular culture, especially the Roman gladiatorial games, bread and circuses, the whole idea, the spectacle. That continued through, you know, by no surprise, during the medieval period, that was often associated with gross sexuality and with stories that were in direct conflict with the gospel. You fast forward to the Victorian era, and one of the things that had common ground for both what we might consider theologically the liberals and the conservatives is they were falling over each other to be more opposed to the popular culture, whether it's Washington Gladden and others who were responding to this. Charles Finney, again, the statement that no saved person should ever read a novel. He said Shakespeare was rubbish. You know, just stay away from popular culture. You know, all the way to, what is it, The Music Man, We Got Trouble in River City. It starts with P and it's pool. You know, the whole thing. And how is it, however, that all of a sudden evangelicals are now primary consumers of popular culture? What happened? How did it now become popular culture or us? What shifted?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. By the way, Timothy Dwight, I believe, said that actors were the offal of society. I thought that was an interesting quote. But, you know, it strikes me that there are rocks on both sides. And you can become, you know, too culturally immersed and compromised, or you can become Amish or something. You know, there's a middle way in there somewhere. And
with due respect to our Amish brothers and sisters.
And I respect, exactly. But the Christ against culture stance is there. I do think that there has been a growing appreciation of this, but I'm not as pessimistic about our making great movies. For one thing, the equipment's getting cheaper, and so you can make things even like Bella and Juno and the like. But it's such a shame to have to let Bruce Beresford and Hugh Hudson and Mel Gibson make the movies we love, The Chariots of Fire and The Trip to Bountiful and The Tender Mercies and so forth. So I'm more bullish about our being able to really enter the fray. But I think there's a kind of insecurity among evangelicals. I think we feel as though we're sort of backward and embarrassing, so we like to get our creds in the culture, and sometimes it's kind of pitiful how hard we work to show that we're cool. That aside, I do think that people are awakening to the splendors and power of film, and that's a healthy thing, I would say.
Well, I guess what interests me is how all of a sudden evangelicals now are consumers of popular culture as if there's no moral question about it, other than we see this movie rather than that movie because of this issue or that issue. But being actively engaged as consumers and appreciators, even curators of popular culture, that's no longer a controversy.
It seems to me there's a kind of trend biblically you see in the history of the Old Testament, and we see it in church history and we see it in our own lives, and that is that generations that follow strict generations of Christians tend to want to go out and learn what it's like to be free. And for instance, when I was a baby Christian learning about this whole new world of Christianity in my 20s, and I had Christian relatives that would not go to a movie theater due to their Christian tradition. They sure couldn't wait till the show came out on television to watch it. That seemed very odd to me. I couldn't quite follow the logic of it. And so people tend to say, well, there's something wrong with that. And I went through all the phases of the Christ and culture almost, you know, once I was pagan, then that was Christ and culture, you know, the whole thing's mixed. And then when I became a baby Christian, I thought you had to reject everything. I mean, I sold everything I had, gave it all away. You know, I wouldn't watch television and so on. And I respect that. I think that's a legitimate Christian option some Christians are going to have with regard to the culture. What they have to be aware of that I was not aware of is that I was creating or actually mimicking my own subculture. I created a new one with its own little rules and acceptable pleasures. And then I went through a phase where, okay, it's acceptable because my kids wanted to see these movies and they were pressured. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to worldview analyze every movie. We're going to make sure, and my kids didn't like that much. I was ruining every movie for them and all my friends, you know. And then there's this sort of thing like, okay, well, you can't avoid culture. You know, you're going to breathe it, so you might as well learn it as an evangelism thing. And I think there's legitimacy to all of these, and it's not an easy call. I mean, I actually laughed and snickered in Avatar when I would see some of the blatant, silly propaganda But
you kept watching.
Yeah, I kept watching because it was captivating, and I also found myself. Okay, you had to get your PG-13 early in because you got to get the cussing in up front. I mean, that's sort of a standard thing. So I don't think there's one standard way that we have to deal with these, but I do think the kind of critical interaction that you're calling for that we don't see in a lot of evangelicalism today is a serious danger.
I think you are exactly right about... I had some friends when I was growing up who came from a very, very strict, independent, fundamentalist kind of family. They were allowed no television, no movies, no anything. They would come to our house, and we would all want to be outside playing in the woods and romping around in the swamps, and they're sitting there watching television with the volume all the way down so nobody would hear, just wrapped in front of it. And we're like, it's Little House on the Prairie. You know, why do you care? But to them, it was so forbidden, they had to see it. And I think that's kind of a generational thing. After you have this kind of don't do this, you can't explore this, you can't have that, the next generation just gets exhausted. Mm-hmm. When there's so many parameters put into place, you can't meet them all, you're just exhausted, and so you just kind of go wild. And now... I think most people in this room have probably seen a movie that your grandparents would consider to be pornographic, mm-hmm. in a way that was not even alarming to you because you don't even have the tools anymore to discern what's there. I think that we've swung back in a direction where there's not even any critical. I'm not worried so much about the things that we watch and think this is horrible. I'm worried about the things that we don't even notice. We just see them and they...
I think the most dangerous film I ever saw was a PG. Mm-hmm. And it was called Same Time Next Year with Alan Alda and Ellen Burstyn. And anyway, it's this guy's up in a lodge in the mountain and meets a lady who'd come up for a spiritual retreat. One thing led to another, and an adulterous affair eventuated, and they would meet each year. And there was no skin in it. I don't think there was cussing. It was just PG, sort of standard. But it showed that adultery is workable and charming if you do it right, you know. And it was, again, it was not scandalous the way a lot of R and X are in NC-17, but it did the damage. And it's very... And by the way, I was at in Cleveland once and went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I remember rock and roll, I guess, was the soundtrack of my youth, so to speak. And I really thought, oh, this would be interesting to hear this or that from Steppenwolf or the Beatles or Buddy Holly or whatever. You go in there, and they have these on a loop. They have silly old preachers in black and white breaking records and throwing stuff into the river and putting a bony finger up there against the devil's music. And so you laugh there. Mm-hmm. And now that we're liberated, we can go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it was exhibit after exhibit of, like, human wreckage. I mean, here's like, you know, Jimi Hendrix vomit or something when he died on drugs. And here's, you know, so-and-so who got shot. And here's so-and-so whose band fell apart. And you think, I think I'm going to go back to the black and white guy breaking the records. We become so cool about it that we don't realize the dangers. And I think you're right. We probably need to... take a deep breath and back away from being so enculturated that we don't have any critical distance now.
Let's talk for just a moment here, as the time's getting away from us, about the particular power of film. Yeah. If you take all the other forms of media and put them aside for a moment, there's something about film that is unique. A recent poll indicated that American adolescents consider film and attending movies to be the choice of the good life. That's what they are aiming for on the weekend, and that's what, of course, those who are producing the movies are hoping for at the box office. It is, as some cinematographers will say, a way of entering a different world. You're in a dark room looking at a massive screen that's larger generally than human beings can take in terms of the visuals perspective, and you really do, as Roger Ebert said, enter a different world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is the power and what is the danger of that?
Well, the danger is when you totally enter into it emotionally, psychologically, your critical faculties are put on the back shelf.
Right.
Discernment is set aside because you just get caught up in it. And I think that's why we can see ourselves thinking, you're rooting for the adulterer and those kinds of things. And that is the power of it. Here again, I'm going to quote Schaefer. He points out how things happen at different levels with media, and particularly, let's say, film. Something can be very good on the technical level, great cinematography, great acting, a powerful, alluring story. And all of that can combine together where we just put our critical faculties on hold. And just all of a sudden you wake up and you say, what am I doing? Who am I rooting for?
Well, you know, we left out one aspect of that, and that's the music.
Oh, of course.
And I met with a faculty member of the UCLA film program who told me that what basically pulls you in some ways, far more powerfully than the dialogue or the visual, is the music. You know, and I have on my iPod, I don't know how many soundtracks, because they're actually, in many cases, marvelous artifacts of music. Yeah. But this film professor said, I can make the UCLA Bruins football team cry. Mm-hmm. He said, all I need to do is have the right string accompaniment to a dog dying, and all those football players are going to be bawling because of the emotional power of this. Yeah. He says it doesn't even have to be much of a story if it's combined with this. And Russ, that makes me think that oftentimes we leave not realizing what actually did reach us.
Exactly.
Maybe we don't know.
Exactly. I think it comes out much later with the kinds of things you kind of form a moral imagination with the kinds of things that you learn to sympathize with or you learn to empathize with. And one of my favorite novels is Walker Percy's The Moviegoer. And the protagonist in that novel is living this really boring, kind of a meaningless life. And he goes to movies constantly because the movies have a coherent theme. They've got a resolution. It ends. I think that's kind of the good side and the glory of what's going on in film. You've got people who can't understand how their lives have meaning and how they fit together, but they're drawn to these movies that do. They've got a storyline. They've got a meaning. They come to a conclusion at the end. They really know that you can't make a meaningless movie. You can make it, but nobody watches it. If you don't have a plot line, if you don't have heroes and villains, and these, nobody watches it because we know that's not the way the world is. And so the fact that more and more people are wanting to go and sit in movies, yeah, it's escapism, but as Tolkien said, you know, who are the people who are most upset about escapism? It's often the jailers who don't want you to escape. We have to ask, what are people wanting to escape to? And they're wanting to escape with the freedom to sin, but ultimately it's because they're made in the image of God. They're wanting to be free from the curse that they're living in. We've got an opportunity to say something different.
Yeah, I think there's no question that parents and pastors mm-hmm. need to sensitively but articulately teach their people how to interact with the culture. Yeah. There's no question about it that when I go back, my wife has corrupted me or liberated me to love Turner Classic Movies, particularly 40s. So that's, you know, really old. But that was during the Hays Code. The Hays Code's ditched in Hollywood in the late 60s. And just look at the movies that come out of that era. They make Avatar look like a really happy movie. A lot of the stuff coming out of that period is all the bad guys and there's no ending that's clear. And so it seems to me our job as Christian leaders, which everyone here is in some sense already a cultural critic to the people looking to you, is to help people think through what it is they are experiencing as entertainment, but they no longer realize has become the prophet and the preacher to them, because they precisely don't critique it. They just let it come on in and do its work.
Or they think it's all just sex. As long as it's not cuss words and naked ladies.
Right.
But you can be glorifying of violence and sarcasm and the works of the flesh without ever knowing you're doing it in a way that's reminiscent of the bread circuses that we're talking
Absolutely.
About.
It's not bad to have a commentary. We would watch ads as a family. We'd be watching TV, and Old Milwaukee Beer would come on, and you'd see these guys fishing, and then they'd pull some Alaskan king crab or bass up on the deck and say, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. And I'd say, well, Caleb, Jedediah, is that true? Does it not get any better than that? And we'd realize that for the lost, it pretty well tops out at beer and fish, you know. But if you can have a running commentary on the culture. By the way, one thing about movies, one guy said that we're voyeurs. I remember a time we were in Washington, and my dad was doing some study, and we were renting a house there. And we were in the basement, and they were having a knockdown, drag-out fight next door, screaming and so forth. And my sister Ann and I were in the basement looking up through the window. Just, I don't think there was anything like that in Arkansas. And we were just thrilled with that. And we were like little voyeurs watching. And there's a voyeur quality to a movie where you're like watching something like, exotic or forbidden. You have the suspension of disbelief. It's just so powerful.
Popular culture is not a new challenge. As we said, it goes all the way back to the earliest generations of Christians. The kind of thinking that's been demonstrated in this conversation is something that really ought to be a part of, well, our constant conversation, not just in negotiating the culture, I think, but in kind of holding each other accountable as Christians to say, what are we watching, what are we reading, what are we listening to, what is that doing to us? What are these products of the culture doing to our children? Those are interesting questions, but it also helps to define our mission field. Because if this is the story that millions of people are paying so much to see, those millions of people are looking for a story.
Right.
And that gives us the opportunity to speak of the story of stories,
absolutely,
the narrative of narratives, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thanks to Mark Coppinger, Jim Parker, Russ Moore, and Ted Cable for this conversation. We'll continue the conversation with further panels later this semester and ongoing. Special appreciation to the panel this morning.